Good morning or good mid-afternoon, as it were. It's a great pleasure for you to be here. The United Nations Development Program is particularly grateful to the organizers for having invited us to be with you today. As you would understand, the United Nations Development Program has a charter both to encourage development, particularly in developing countries, from an economic standpoint, but perhaps most importantly, with a focus or emphasis on social development and social welfare. And we have been quite active in the area of access to medicine and other healthcare services, and one of our particular focuses over the past number of years has been in the area of competition law and regulation. We prepared and published a few years ago a guidebook on use of competition law to promote access to healthcare technologies, which is readily available to you on the UNDP's website. And we've also been involved in conducting various training programs in countries around the world and hosting seminars that a number of you have been at, for example, in Pretoria about a year and a half ago. So we've been quite active in this area. So to begin, I'd note that issues concerning the pricing and availability of access to medicines really became a major focal point in the international community in the late 1990s and early 2000s, largely arising out of the HIV pandemic and questions surrounding the affordability of access to treatments for HIV. We've come a long way since that time. Initially, a major part of the focus, and continues to be a major part of the focus, was access among poorer developing country populations. But as the prices of medicines have continued to escalate, and so now having, for example, a treatment for hepatitis C rising to $84,000 for a single course of treatment, budgets in the OECD countries have become very stretched as well by the procurement difficulties, and in the process, for example, of the UN Secretary General's high-level panel on access to medicines. We had a number of presentations from OECD countries, notably, for example, the Netherlands, discussing the enormous pressure that are put on their governmental budgets by problems with access to medicines and medicines pricing. Over the years, I've become increasingly convinced that competition law is a, if not the, main instrument that needs to be used to promote more affordable access to medicines. And a lot of this is a political economy problem for a variety of reasons. Many of them having to do with money, it is often very difficult to convince legislators to adopt legislation and regulations that get at the root causes of problems with affordable access to medicine. And competition authorities, we heard this just a few minutes ago from the Philippine Executive Director about the independence of the competition authority. One of the great facets of competition law is that the competition authorities, at least nominally or should be, independent of the political process. Of course, that's easier said than done. But the ability of the competition authorities to go after this conduct without needing to worry so much about the political repercussions provides a mechanism for addressing access to the medicines problem that may be more advantageous than going directly through the legislature or legislative ground. Just start with a few instances of substantial activity that's been going on in this area over the past number of years. For those of you who may not be familiar with it, I certainly recommend that you download and read it. The European Competition Directorate did a very deep and detailed study of the European pharmaceutical sector, a report published in 2009, that tried to determine what the roadblock to affordability of medicines in the European community were, and they identified specifically practices of the originator industries with respect to patenting and other forms of regulatory market exclusivity. So, for example, a ubiquitous problem as patent terms on originator drugs near their end, companies would file large numbers of prospectively spurious patents so that you would have literally thousands of patent applications being filed that weren't necessarily out to valid with respect to the innovative characteristics of the medicines, but for the generic companies to challenge these patents or for the competition authorities to challenge these patents, it could take a number of years before the drugs were able to enter the market. The same abuses of regulatory data exclusivity and patent term extensions, and among other notable circumstances was buyouts and patent challenges. The consequence of all this was to institute a continuous monitoring program for patent challenge buyouts. We now, for example, in Europe have the Dutch authorities conducting a review of the role of patents and market exclusivity and extensions in the entry of generic drugs into the market. I'll get back to the activities of the CMA in the United Kingdom, which is really the step to the forefront of activities in the competition authority in the pharmaceutical sector. Right now, the South African Competition Commission has a broad health sector inquiry underway. We see a lot of activity from the various, the tripartite competition authorities in China have initiated a large-scale pharmaceutical sector inquiry. And that has to be understood in the context of a real transformation being undertaken in the way the Chinese pharmaceutical distribution system and pricing system is currently underway. They've moved from a price control system and a system in which the hospitals were responsible for the procurement and dispensing of medicines, and that's where they got their margins to actually operate the hospital. They're moving away from that to a service-based model and changing the way the distribution arrangement works in China. And contemporaneous with that large-scale transformation, a very ramped up attention to potential anti-competitive practices in the procurement sector so that they can keep prices under control. Similarly, the Competition Authority of India has initiated a broad-scale baseline inquiry into the pharmaceutical sector. What's very important about competition law is that it provides an enormous amount of flexibility to address particular circumstances. And I'm not going to go through, because it's a sophisticated audience, the various types of actions that can be taken under competition law. But I would like to make one key point, is that the way competition law is going to be applied in the pharmaceutical and healthcare sector is very country-specific, because virtually every country has different characteristics about the way its regulatory structure, its patent structure, its generic entry structure, its distribution structure, its classification of drugs and pricing. All of these are organized differently. So it's difficult to say that there's a single one-size-fits-all approach. One really needs to conduct the appropriate investigations and figure out what the right tool is for a particular job at hand. I'll come back in a minute just as an illustration of the UK's action against Pfizer with an illustration about how that specificity can become important. One of the most notable things from a competition law standpoint about the pharmaceutical sector is that in terms of the high-priced drugs, the originator patented drugs, you have a product that is protected by a legislatively approved grant of exclusivity. And this presents a challenge to competition law authority. For example, if you take the traditional issue of monopolization, it's not illegal for a company to obtain a monopoly. It's only illegal for a company to abuse a monopoly or dominant position. Well, in the pharmaceutical sector, it is the legislative board, typically, that grants exclusivity in the form of a patent or exclusivity in the form of regulatory market exclusivity. And one of the reasons that's done is to encourage innovation. And so we have this continuing challenge in this sector, is how do you balance the market exclusivity rights that are given to promote innovation on the one hand, and the problem of access to affordable medicines on the other, and how do you get to the root causes of higher prices when you've granted a company the right to exclude third parties from the market. So this is a very difficult challenge for competition authority. We have a very important decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013, the FTC activist case, where we had the question come up with different circuits split on the question of the extent to which the grant of a patent actually would provide some form of immunity against antitrust prosecution. This in the case of these buyouts of generic entry challenges. And the Supreme Court very clearly said that a patent does not provide an immunity from competition action. It does not provide a shield of when a company is engaged in abusive anti-competitive conduct. So we have that important precedent now in the United States of late. So the pharmaceutical industry, in its own way, is not so different than other industries in the sense of basic types of anti-competitive practices. Many, if not most, governments do a lot of the supply of pharmaceuticals through government procurement, typically large-scale government bidding and procurement practices. These types of practices open themselves up to bid rigging and corruption, and if you look at the number of anti-competitive actions brought over the past decade, you'll see that bid rigging places pretty high on the list of the type of anti-competitive conduct that's undertaken. But another major area is in delaying generic market entry. So, and this again depends on the structure of a particular market, but one element which I already mentioned is the filing of spurious or weak patents toward the end of patent terms that block market entry. Another phenomenon which competition authorities are focusing on of late is a phenomenon called product switching. It goes under various names. But basically, a company, as it's reaching the end of the exclusivity term, and it can either be a patent exclusivity term or a regulatory exclusivity term, will withdraw the currently high-priced product registration, and in the meantime, of course, they have to get the timing right, submit an application for registration for a slightly different version of the same product so that they can get a regulatory exclusivity on the new form of the product while withdrawing the registration for the old form of the product that then requires them to switch the position from the old product to the new product. But by engaging in this practice of switching, regulatory switching, and advertising and promotion, are very effectively able to extend the duration of high pricing. And so we've seen a lot of action recently among competition authorities to address this problem. And then, of course, the usual problem of the buyout of patent challenges. It is evident that if a company is making $1 billion a year profit on a particular patented drug, and they are challenged by a generic producer, that it is a lot more cost effective for the patent owner to pay the challenger $50 million or $100 million to drop the lawsuit and continue earning the profits, and as the U.S. Supreme Court pointed out, the loser in that circumstance is the consumer, who ends up paying higher prices. Both the originator and the generic challenger win. They both made money, but the consumer and the public health authority is paying for a number of years. One area that I have been focusing on recent years from an academic standpoint is excessive pricing of pharmaceuticals. And most countries' competition laws expressly or by jurisprudential development allow actions against producers for charging excessive prices. I'm going to have someone from the OECD here, as there was a detailed study of this issue of excessive pricing in 2011 by the OECD, and at that time it was noted that while these laws are on the book, they have actually been used in a fairly limited way, fairly sporadically. And one thing I have been trying to do for a few years now is encouraging competition authorities to look more closely and take advantage of these excessive pricing doctrines in the pharmaceutical area. I'm pleased to note that the CMA, the British Competition Authority, recently fined Pfizer and Flynn a record 84 million British pounds for engaging in a scheme which enabled the raising of the price of a generic drug by 12,000% as a form of abuse dominant position and excessive pricing. That decision is now under appeal by the pharmaceutical companies, but it illustrates one of the things we're noting, just as a side note, and you see this in various countries, including the United States, is it is not only in the sector of originator patented pharmaceuticals that we're seeing pricing excesses. We're also seeing these pricing excesses in the generic sector, where for one reason or another, there's a bottleneck in the potential for multiple suppliers of the same product. And for example, in this case in the UK, the holders of a brand designation, which is subject to price control in the United Kingdom, were able to de-brand the product and raise the prices even though the products were generic, and to raise the prices in a very excessive way. The use of excessive pricing doctrine, and I've provided the organizers, and I encourage you at some point to take a look at it, a fairly lengthy article that I drafted a year ago on use of excessive pricing doctrine, because it raises some important issues, that is the doctrine. That is, in order, from a competition law standpoint, in order to say that a price is excessive, one must necessarily establish what would be a reasonable baseline price. And how do you go about establishing what is a reasonable price in the pharmaceutical sector, particularly when you're talking about originator products that might include money invested in R&D, and with respect to pharmaceuticals and R&D, you have to take into account risk factors. And so an analysis of a risk-adjusted reasonable price for an originator product can be challenging, but it can be done. And my own view is that the obstacles that are present, that are typically presented to establishing reasonable prices for originator products, are not as much of a barrier as they have been made out to be. And of course, we have a lot of activities going on now encouraging transparency with respect to R&D costs. Of course, the industry's typical response is, well, it's just very expensive to create a new drug, so don't even ask us. It's just very expensive, and we can't tell you, and so you'll never know how much it actually costs us to develop this drug. Well, we all know that that can't be the way the pharmaceutical industry works. The chief financial officer of a major originator company isn't sitting in his or her office saying, oh yeah, just go out and spend as much money as you possibly can, don't worry about it, tell us when it's all over how much it costs to develop that drug. We know they have budgets, we know they can allocate costs, and as competition authorities, you can determine what those costs are. Very briefly, we had just some discussion, I should say, but mergers and acquisitions are a very important issue in terms of the pharmaceutical sector. Very often in mergers and acquisitions, the combining companies have a same or similar drug, and when the acquisition takes place, they'll withdraw one of those drugs from the market, reducing competition. So you have to be very careful in the analysis of the ATC class of drugs and what may or may not be withdrawn from the market. The typical remedy, for example, in the United States is the divestiture of one of the companies of a particular drug to a third party, so you don't lose the competition. Another familiar outcome of mergers and acquisitions is actually a reduction in the level of funding committed to R&D. The typical response is to cut back on the number of researchers in the company, and again, a phenomenon that I'm sure you are all familiar with. Well, you're all competition authorities, so I'm not going to, spend a lot of time going into the various ways that can be used to address any competitive practices. I do note that in the pharmaceutical sector, you have a couple, some relatively, you might say, atypical approaches that include the imposition of price controls and monitoring, compulsory licensing of patents, granted non-exclusive licenses to third parties to produce a particular royalty rate. And another is the reimbursement to the procurement authorities of amounts that were improvidently spent. For example, the revisions to Australia's patent and regulatory marketing system provided that if a company abused the patent system to prolong the market exclusivity of the drug, they would be responsible for reimbursing the drug procurement authority for the amount spent above what should have been spent in terms of that activity. So there's various creative ways that one can go about addressing these problems. Just a final word. I want to distinguish two things. One is the ASEAN-type discussion of coordinating regulatory provisions and investigatory capacity and even the potential for undertaking joint actions and information sharing and so forth. This is a very valuable type of integration effort, experience sharing, capacity enhancement, and so forth. One thing you are seeing today, and you have to have a nice historical perspective on this, if you go back all the way to the late 1940s, where the International Trade Organization was being formed and moving forward, the multinational business community has always been hostile to international competition rules and any kind of harmonized provisions on the theory that more attention is paid in this area, we're likely to be subject to more competition action and enforcement. So up until, I would say, 6 or 7 years ago, any proposal for the multinational negotiation of competition rules was opposed by the multinational business community. You're starting to see a shift in that perspective. You're starting to hear more noise about, well, maybe we should harmonize the rules. Maybe we should add additional regulatory hurdles which have to be overcome in this area to address competition problems. This isn't because the supporting governments and the multinational business community have suddenly woke up and said, you know, we'd really like to be subject to more competition enforcement action. It's that they have become increasingly concerned that countries like Brazil, India, China, the Philippines are going to start more aggressively enforcing their competition laws and even pursuing approaches that aren't necessarily the same approaches that are being pursued in the United States and the European Union and so forth. So now you're having a reaction that says, well, before we were worried about being subjected to these rules, now we're actually more worried about actually having to be subject to these enforcement actions. So maybe we need some rules that make it more difficult for countries to prosecute us. So I merely raised just something to keep up your antenna about, that when you hear proposals for increased harmonization of competition norms, you approach that with a bit of wariness, because it may be that these rules are more designed to constrain the activities of competition authorities than to promote them. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to take any questions, comments, observations. I've tried to make it possible for everyone to get a point.
Hi, I'm Hasim from Shibuya Commission. I'm quite interested in the discussion of excessive pricing. So when we talk about the excessive pricing, we always talk how to establish the reasonable price as a benchmark in order to determine the excessive pricing. Because when we look at the supply side, we look at cost and also profit. Let's say the profit that the company will take is around 100%, and we say that it is unreasonable. The question is, how do we justify that it is unreasonable? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. And as I alluded to in my remarks, this is a difficult issue. And again, you have differences in sectors in establishing a baseline. What was the cost of development? And you're correct. So the cost of development will vary depending on the sector. The cost of development of a generic can be very easily identified just based on the replication of the existing chemical or biological product, whereas the cost of developing an innovative product involves a risk-based assessment, which can involve taking a look at. So competition and competition authorities are not unused to looking at developmental costs spread out across a number of different developmental projects. So one of the suggestions I made in my article is that if you're looking at the cost of developing a particular originator product and you're looking at a particular company which has been involved in a number of related R&D efforts in the same area within the company, that in terms of risk-adjusted cost, and this is a question of fact, and expert testimony, one can look at the projects that are reasonably related to the ultimate development cost, and then you may have to factor in things like government expenses and R&D projects, how much you can back out of the cost, tax credits you can back out of the cost, and eventually get to a kind of a benchmark developmental cost. When you look at profit, so I'll start with a general observation that, you know, in some of the most egregiously excessive cases we've looked at, the profit margins are so extreme that asking, should it be 12%, 15%, or 25%, is hardly the point when the excess is 12,000%. And so, in terms of what a reasonable profit should be, one can look at the ways one looks at other industry sectors, right? That is, what is the average or normal profit in the industry. And I'm not talking about, even my concern isn't whether an industry is making 12%, 15%, 18% profit. I mean, all of those things are within reasonable margins, right? The question is whether you get to 150%, 500%, 1,000% differential profit. Those on their face might be looked at as excessive prices, and then what you look at is the reasonable benchmark. One of the problems you run into, for example, with the originator industry, is that there is widespread, I would say, excessive prices. So, you know, one talks about, for example, say what's typical in the EU and in other areas, to look at reference pricing as a benchmark for determining what should be the normal price of a pharmaceutical product. Well, that assumes that the average or reference price within the region is itself a reasonable price. And I think there's a number of cases in which you can say that the reference price is an excessive price. So, you know, my own preference is that you look at cost of development plus a reasonable profit margin, and that reasonable profit margin should include an amount of return for future R&D, right? So, again, I'm 100% in favor of innovation. I'm 100% against abusing a consumer. So, how do you go from a reasonable return on R&D funding to excessive pricing? Again, it's not easy, but I think that these problems are ones that can be solved by competition authorities. And I'm sorry for a too long answer, but it's a very complex problem, and one which has presented an obstacle to the use of this kind of doctrine, and I think one that very seriously needs to be addressed.
I'm very glad you're focused on this issue of excessive pricing, because this thing about we don't know how to cost the actual production and development cost of medicine is wrong, really. So it's a very good issue to work and done to impact and that competition politics is that. So I really appreciate the work around this. And I think what we do need is a lot more capacity of our competition bodies to be able to ask the right questions. In terms of how to do that, I also wanted to ask you to maybe comment on your rewarding harmonization is really very timely, because a lot of trade agreements and regional harmonization is looking at competition in a very different way from the way you're looking at competition in your organization for competition. So maybe some comments from you about the multiple trade agreements, plurilateral trade agreements that many of our countries have been actually talking to. And lastly, what is your experience in terms of anti-competitive behavior as a form of cost-driven international
interaction? All right, thank you very much. First, one more word, and I've said too much about it already about pricing, but I would note that the WHO and Dutch government are beginning a project on trying to establish in a more detailed way fair pricing, what the benchmark should be, and I think there's a renewed focus or a major focus in this area. And one thing, of course, which is very important, is sharing experience, sharing information among competition authorities and other regulatory authorities. In terms of the free trade agreement, it is no secret, for example, everyone in the room is familiar with this, in the TPP negotiations, If perhaps the most controversial issue in the entire set of negotiations was the extension of biologics market exclusivity and what the duration of that would be. So the United States was, you know, demanding initially a 12-year marketing exclusivity for biologics, which is the current standard in the United States, while at the same time the Obama administration was trying to reduce the market exclusivity period in the United States to 7 years. So it was trying to reduce the period in the United States while it was trying to increase the period of the TPP. And ultimately, you ended up with a market exclusivity period of 8 years for biologics or 5+3. Now, what is that market exclusivity period? That is a period during which a biosimilar drug may not be introduced and potentially may not even begin the process of submitting to the regulatory authority for the introduction of the biosimilar. When the U.S. Federal Trade Commission examined this prior to our adoption in 2011 of our exclusivity period, they said no biologics market exclusivity period should be adopted and none is needed because these products are either covered by patents or they aren't. If they're covered by effective patents, they'll be protected. They don't need a separate, essentially mandated period of biologics exclusivity. Why do companies like regulatory exclusivity? Because it's extremely difficult to challenge. Patents can be challenged. We know the route. Once the regulatory authority says, I've approved your biologic drug, there are very few routes to challenge that grant of exclusivity, so it becomes exceedingly difficult to introduce a biosimilar. So a lot of the attention on the FDA is indeed to competition in the pharmaceutical sector. With respect to competition rules, well, I should mention the other important part of the FDA, which is a little bit off track. So the newest development the FDA, which we saw in Australia first, and then South Korea, even to a bigger extent, is granting the originator companies the authority to intervene in the determinations by the healthcare authorities as to what drugs will be included on formularies for reimbursement and to challenge the price determination by the governments as to what the pricing for reimbursement will be. This is a major regulatory intervention by originator companies. It's something that very few commentators have paid any attention to, but represents a dramatic break from past practice with respect to how pharmaceutical benefit schemes are operated. So that's a major change in these FDAs. There's been limited additional rulemaking with regard to competition. Mainly, it's been a bit of additional transparency, which so far I don't see as presenting a major issue, but you know, these things begin in a small way and tend to develop into a larger way as time goes on. So I don't know what to want. I hope I've said enough about that. So my throat has been sitting on the ground. Hopefully there's a pharmaceutical that can help me with that. And I thank you all for your attention. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Professor Frederick Ebert, for such an inspiring discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, now we will adjourn for lunch. We've been informed that the next session